It is time for another journey deep into the lining of the magical talking hat. Hat wranglers Tony and William reach into the yawning chasm that is the hat and pull forth the questions you have posed. Will they tire of your question quickly? Is your name Azhatalin? Then perhaps they will, but then perhaps not. But that will remain a mystery until we venture into the magical talking hat.
The magic has begun.
The magic has begun.
Yes.
I like that.
Yes.
It doesn't seem very accurate, but...
Arthur Clarke said, technology of a sufficiently advanced state is indistinguishable from magic, and I have no idea how Audacity works. So. Magic!
So you're saying the hat isn't magical, it's just a technological beyond our understanding.
Yes, it's 2009 level technology, which is beyond me. That's when shit gets magic. 2009. That's the year technology left me behind. I was like, I don't even know anymore. It's all just magic to me now. That's why I don't own a cell phone. I have not figured out the proper goblin to call up to request one.
The interesting thing about what you're saying, though, is that there's a certain level.
I refuse to believe there's something interesting.
No, there is something interesting about it. There's a certain level where nobody really knows how this stuff works. I mean,
because it's 2009.
No. I'm saying even the people who are experts in the field, they know how to exploit the phenomenon to make the thing, but they have no idea what the phenomena is, where it comes from, why it works the way it does. They're just glad that it does because they can exploit it in this way and get a device that they want, which isn't unlike the way a lot of magical systems are portrayed in fiction.
True. You know, honestly, I think you also just explained TLC's entire programming line.
But I mean, isn't that true? A lot of magical systems are portrayed. Well, there's this thing called magic. You don't know what it is or how it works, but you know if you use this incantation or use this object or do these certain things, you can get it to do what you want.
Well, that's amongst magic scholars. That is a common place where the schools of thought separate. There are schools of, and I'm talking real, like,
sure,
honestly trying to practice magic kind of stuff. The opposite, the two extremes are basically, for example, chaos magic, which sort of comes down to, it doesn't matter what you do as long as you believe in it.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other side would be like Aleister Crowley and Thelema, where it doesn't matter what's in your head. You do this with this thing at this time, and that happens.
Hmm.
So you get both. But, and in the former, I'd say it doesn't apply. But in the latter, yeah, absolutely.
Well, when it comes to technology, there are certain things that we've figured out. And again, there's a lot of magical systems in fiction that are portrayed this way. People studied it, and they figured out that magic is this thing that even though we don't know what it is or where it came from or how it really works, we know that it follows certain rules.
Yeah.
So if we follow those rules, we can make magic work. And so that's why wizards or magic wielders are often portrayed as studious people who study these things. Well, how is that
different from gravity?
Well, or electricity or the electron? I mean, we have theories about how these things work that help us manipulate them. When it comes right down to it, we don't know what this stuff really is, where it comes from, why it works. We just have figured out through experimentation that it does work this way. So in a way, a cell phone is not that much different than a magical object that you find in a lot of magical fiction.
Or the free version of Audacity that you can download. So, hello, everyone. Welcome to the magic. Welcome to the Magical Talking Hat podcast,
mm-hmm.
The only podcast in the world that wasn't trying to scare you. It was trying to warn you about the other podcast on the roof of your car with a hook for a hand. I'm Tony.
And I'm William. And this is episode 242. I guess this would be our fifth Halloween.
No, I think it's
episode.
Our fourth.
No, fifth.
Is it our fifth?
Because didn't we start in
2011?
March. So October 2011, 12, 13, 14, 15.
All right. This is our first one. And that's it. Because I feel like I already did the joke about how the podcast died on this road 25 years ago. So this time we were just trying to warn you about the other podcast. Hook for a hand.
Yep. Halloween is Saturday.
And I'm pretty sure we've already been the podcast coming from inside the house. I think we've done that one too. Weirdly, I think we're canceling Halloween.
Why? What?
Well, tradition dictates that we order a particular dish for delivery from Wig and Penn, and we eat it, and trick-or-treaters show up, and we give them candy.
Sure.
I believe what we're actually going to do now, although it's still a little bit reworked out, we will have the neighbor kids come over to trick-or-treat because we like doing that and we get to see their costumes and it's a good practice for them. It's like in the first house so that they make sure they remember all the rules.
Right.
And then I think we're going to go get us some Detroit-style pizza and then go see The Last Witch Hunter.
Oh.
Which apparently is terrible, but Trish really wants to see it, and I kind of really want to see it too, so we're going to go do it. Due to a scheduling conflict, date night, which is normally Wednesday nights, is on hold for like a couple months. And so the producer was like, I think I'm in withdrawal from date night, so we should have a date this weekend. And she decided Saturday would be fun for that.
Well, that's not really canceling Halloween. That's just doing something a little different.
But it's not Halloween related, though. So.
Well, I don't know. We're actually not going to be at our house for Halloween either.
Oh, my goodness.
As we have been for the last 10 or 11 years.
Yeah,
because
you do
the
big old feast and stuff.
Yeah, there's...
What are you doing?
This will be the first time we haven't been at the house in... since we moved in. And I'm having a hard time remembering when that was. It was after...
2009.
I think it's been 11 years ago. We're going to go to the lake. I don't know if people have been paying attention, but my wife and I have been going to Clear Lake,
yeah.
Iowa, lots in the last year. Both sets of grandparents were from there originally, and actually both of her parents grew up there. All of her other grandparents had passed away except her grandmother, and she passed away earlier this year.
Anywhere near it? Where even is it?
No. It's stuck underneath the...
Too bad, kitten.
Sure. But she passed away earlier this year, sadly. But there's been a lot of reason to go up to the lake since then. So we've been up there a lot, and we're going to be going up on Saturday. Well, we'll probably be going up tomorrow and be there all weekend. But we will be doing Halloween stuff. There's a haunted attraction up there. I don't know. I think we're going to be handing out candy to trick-or-treaters in the lake house there and things like that. But we won't be in Coralville for Halloween this year.
Mm-hmm. All right. We got a lot of stuff to cover, but I got to get the crap out of the way. For those of you just joining us, what episode number is this again?
242, I think.
242. Mm-hmm. That's a little late to the game, but welcome.
We haven't done that part yet.
We've got a community that will welcome you with open arms. Right, guys? Yeah. Here's how it works. We have a hat. It's magical. Has its own email address, themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. And people, spooky people, or just people, write into that email address with little notes, little comments, topics, questions, things like that. Keep them short. Stuff like that. And the hat, all on its own, magically transmogrifies those emails into little note cards with the information written on them that manifest physically within the hat itself. I will explain to you what those are doing there in a minute. We, its ectoplasmic servants, draw the note cards out of the hat at random, read them on the air, talk about them till we're bored, do that for about an hour. That's the whole show. David asked if Trish and I would be interested in helping further playtest that game. And I said, that's one of the games he had at... I assume that's what you were looking at.
Oh, Metropolis?
Yeah. What were you looking at?
I was looking at that, among other things.
And I said, maybe. And so he said, okay, we'll send you two copies in the mail. I'm like, what? But apparently it's the size of a Chick tract, so it wasn't that difficult to mail them. So he sent those.
You guys playtested this?
No, but it's in playtest mode. So Ben and Val played it with him on Saturday. We were busy playing Worlds of Peril.
While we were doing that, okay.
Ben and Val and David were doing Metropolis.
Gotcha.
Anyway, I'm getting kind of... No, I want to bring up something, Lou.
Okay.
Because you talked about Clear Lake, which made me think of Crystal Lake.
Okay.
This is a thing that's been bugging me today. And I don't know why it took me this long to figure out. Slasher movies are different now than they were back when they kind of started. People talk about, like, oh, slasher movies nowadays, they're just, you know, people are just taking Friday the 13th and doing it over again kind of thing. No. Here's the thing. Nowadays, slasher movies, like a lot of horror movies, are mostly a story of people doing something terrible, and then somebody ends up as, like, a disfigured monster or dead and a vengeful ghost or something, and then they get their comeuppance in really horrible ways. Back in the day, you didn't have that. You take Friday the 13th. Friday the 13th, the catalyst is Jason's at summer camp, and he falls in the water, and none of the counselors do shit for him, so then he's going to drown, and then it's all terrible. And he's going to get his vengeance later. Except here's what happens. They don't do anything. They're little shitheads. And then they leave, and they go home, and they grow up, and they have kids, and live their lives, and never come back to Crystal Lake again. Meanwhile, 20 years later or whatever, other random, dare I say innocent, campers and counselors show up, and they get fucking murdered.
Which, that, I mean, that actually goes along with the traditional ghost story. I mean,
yeah,
when you think about it, a ghost story, some character becomes a ghost or monster or whatever, usually due to some tragic circumstance, and then they haunt a place, and everybody who visits that place is tortured by them. Yes. Not necessarily the people...
out of a sense of vengeance, but those people are not the ones who
committed... If someone caused that trauma, they're often not even on the scene anymore.
And you still get that sometimes nowadays, but with a slasher movie nowadays, often it's... the same people come back, or like if it's like the kid was humiliated in high school and then they leave, then it's like the reunion when all that kind of shit goes down and stuff like that. Or on rare occasions, and Nightmare on Elm Street kind of did this, it's the children of the people who wronged them and stuff like that. But back in the day, most of the slasher things were like, no, you just happened to be the prop that showed up at the right time for me to massacre, which is way less fair and makes the bloodthirsty monsters way less sympathetic, but it's right. Also scarier and more tragic in a way.
Well, and again, it follows the tradition of hauntings in general.
Yeah.
I mean, the Amityville Horror, for example, which is supposed to have been an actual haunting, that's not...
Except it's by the Warren, so fuck them.
But the point is, that's not something that happened to the people who caused the original haunting. It's happening to people who are living in the house. And this is how a lot of, I don't know about the tradition of ghost stories like worldwide or something in culture. I don't know if there are certain cultures where all hauntings are revenge or whatever. But for Gothic horror, the Gothic horror tradition that was started, I don't know when it was started, but that we can trace back to the 19th century at least, or actually the 18th century. There's definitely... you can start a story with this place is haunted by this ghost. You don't even need to explain how the ghost got there, what tragedy made the ghost real. All that matters is these people are there now, and the ghost is bothering them. Yeah. And lots of stories, well, you alluded to the guy with the hook or that story.
Yeah.
Nobody really, when the story was originally told to people, nobody really got into the backstory of the guy with the hook. Or
just
it didn't matter.
Yeah.
But you're saying that it's kind of a popular trend in recent slasher movies for them to really develop the backstory and make the people who are the victims of the haunting actually kind of deserve it.
In slasher movies, I'm not even going to say in horror movies, because as Trish pointed out, there's a subgenre that's been around for a while, but has become growing in popularity, which is what I like to call the last house on the left subgenre, which is usually it's not supernatural. Usually it's people show up and do terrible things to you, but it's very much sort of at random. You have no connection. And some movie, it might have been The Last House on the Left. There was one movie where this was a thing, and near the climax of it, all the victims are tied up and they've been, you know, tormented or whatever, and the bad guys are there and they've all got masks on, and one of the victims is sobbing, "Why are you doing this?" And one of the torturers says, "Because you are home." And that's like just chilling in a whole separate way, that you're just the random, you know, Sam Peckinpah, a lot of stuff like that. And that's a genre that's been around forever, and that's sort of the point of that one. But I feel like nowadays, I don't know, it may be the whole idea that as slasher movies became more popular, people started rooting for the slasher. Like, people go to Friday the 13th movies and they aren't like, "Oh, I fucking hate Jason Voorhees, he's a monster." They're like, "No, go, Jason, go." And so I think there's this implication that now we have to make it that, oh, these people deserve it. Whereas when you go back to the beginning, arguably, Jason has only ever killed one person who specifically wronged him. And spoiler alert for the first two Friday the 13th movies, if you never saw them, the first Friday the 13th movie has no Jason in it. It's Jason's mom. And she dies at the end. Somebody kills her. And in the second movie, Jason is mad about that and kills a bunch of people, but also that person. Technically, that person wronged him by killing his mom, and he kills. Actually, I saw it today. I think 417 people throughout all the movies he's in.
Jeez.
And so only the one actually wronged him specifically.
Well, in storytelling history, the precedent for what you're talking about is The Revenant, of course.
Yeah.
And in fact, early vampires were thought to be specifically revenants, and a revenant is a monster, usually not ghostly. Usually this monster has a body or whatever, but that specifically is coming back to plot revenge on a specific, not necessarily the person who killed them, but that's an easy one, but someone who wronged them in some way, or someone they were mad at or whatever. And I think even in old stories, people who got in the way of the revenant, who didn't necessarily wrong them in life, could still get killed or whatever. But so revenants go back a long ways. But, you know, I suppose those stories have been around for a long time, the story where the person the person being haunted, they're being haunted by someone they wronged. I guess that's been around for a while.
But I mean, the Japanese have, like, the hungry ghost concept, and that's the exact opposite. And I believe the implication has always been there that the ghosts are not, have lost their reason at that point. So they think they're getting revenge, but they don't realize that the person there is not. But I've already discussed how Asians are obsessed with mistaken identity anyway, so the ghosts just fit in with
that. Well, the ghost stories in the United States, in post-colonial United States, almost never involve revenants. I mean, not in the sense of them coming back to get someone. You can find stories like that.
Yeah.
But most of the, like, when you're just traveling through the United States, and like I am, I get interested in, you know, I'll go to a visitor center that has a bunch of books about the state in it, and I always look for the book that's about local ghost stories, because there always is one.
And I feel like a lot of those ones are trespass and toll-taking. Like,
yeah,
you suffer because you trespassed in the place where this ghost is, or because anybody who does XYZ has to pay
the
ghost, essentially.
And there's a lot of them that are just what I call phantom stories, where you just go somewhere and you see a spirit, I guess, or an apparition repeating something over and over again. They don't do anything to you, but you get creeped out by it because it's creepy. Yes. There's a lot of that.
Those are not...
I don't know.
Ooh.
I don't know.
Ghost story as xenophobia.
I don't know what it is, but that's probably, for me, I don't know if it's the most common story I've seen in my travels, but it's a very, just about every place is going to have one of those where you go to this place and you'll see the ghost doing something.
Yeah. Well, that's an easy one, because that one, like, well, as we know, I don't believe in ghosts. And
well, nor do I.
Well, and
I
recent,
love ghost stories.
Recent shit has come up that has potentially explained a lot of what ghost sightings are. All the stuff with infrasound
stuff like that. We've talked about that.
And the kind of encounter you're talking about is the kind that works there. It's a lot harder to be like, and then he took my husband's head off. Like, oh, no, that's just because of that weird infrasound. That's what took off your husband's head. Like, no, that's not a, you know.
Well, that's a good point. I think one of the reasons those stories might be really popular is because they're easier to believe, like you said.
Yeah, you can't go and say, they turned me into a newt, but I got better. But you can totally be like, there's this freaky... And I'm not saying these people are lying, but I'm saying you can go and have that experience.
Yeah, there's no...
You're not going to go and do the weird things, your face gets ripped off. You know,
well,
or,
now,
or you were never seen from again. I mean, sometimes that happens, but
sometimes the, but a lot of times the most compelling stories that individual people tell. These aren't the folklore stories of a local community, but that people tell themselves about why they believe in ghosts. And I have a friend who told a story like this: is they were lying in bed minding their own business, and their sheets got ripped off of them by an unseen force, or they felt a weight on top of them, or things like that. But as you say, these experiences don't leave any kind of evidence behind, or they don't, you know what I'm saying? They're easy.
And there are explanations for a lot of them.
Well, that's, but yeah. they're easy stories to creep people out with, because they're not so outrageous, right?
And they're both impossible to prove and largely impossible to disprove.
Right, that's right.
There are exceptions. There are some incredibly haunted places that literally, like, they fixed a fan, like a vent fan, and suddenly the ghost sightings stopped because it was just whirring at that frequency.
Yeah.
But most of the time, it's like, yeah, you can't prove it, but you can't really disprove it either. I'm going to stop us on this because we're only like 20 minutes in, and you and I have got some other big shit that we got to talk about.
Yeah, because...
how was your week?
Well, I probably the biggest news for both of us is we attended the first CorridorCon.
CorridorCon. Hosted, from Corridor Games On Demand.
Hosted by...
Dave Avid, listener.
Listener Dave Avid, yeah.
And Dave Avid's wife.
Yep.
Who did sometime listener.
Who did an excellent job with...
Who worked her butt off.
Her part of the convention. And it's I have never been to a gaming convention of any kind or sort or size before, nor had my wife, so...
And my wife also came and also gamed.
Yeah.
Which I believe, technically, this is probably the third time she has ever gamed.
In her life.
A role-playing game. One time was just some playtesting of one of David's games... And then one time we played Fiasco on vacation, and that's it. And then now she played. I went to college with a guy, and we played a game with him, and there were zombies. In my apartment in Coralville. Jared Seaman, what did we play? I remember the incident. I straight up don't remember what we were playing. Okay, so maybe it's the fourth time.
Well, I think before the convention, I don't think my wife and I had played role playing games more than less than ten times
just
in our life.
Into it, but most of those are very recently.
Yeah.
Like you're beginning a journey here.
Yeah. So, I've never been to a convention before, obviously, as I just said, but it seemed like it was a success as conventions go.
I think it went well. It was very small scale. It was very specific to gaming and only gaming. But it was also set up by like three people. So, and it did exactly what, like, we all had a good time. We got a lot of gaming in. It was awesome. I met some cool people. Very pleased.
Yeah, great.
I hope he manages to do more of that. He's always at the local, like Icon and Gamacon and stuff. There's a Games On Demand table there. And William and I finally got to play in a game together.
Yep. First time.
I played a multi-armed alien, and William played the saddest Batman ever.
Or saddest Iron Man.
Or the saddest Iron Man. Or, yeah. Or FMLA War Machine. Those were my two nicknames for his character, Sad Batman and FMLA War Machine. And I only played in two games. And the producer only played in one game. And you probably played in like four or five.
Four. Yep. Three on Saturday and one on Sunday.
Sunday.
Yep. How? So, but you left early on Saturday or something?
No, we arrived late.
You arrived late. That's right. Lunch. That's right. You arrived late.
Because on the weekend, I stay up late and I sleep in late. And I wasn't going to change that. And then we didn't come on Sunday because we were exhausted. Good times. I finally got to play some games that are powered by the apocalypse, as they say.
How'd you feel about that?
Pretty intrigued. I like the idea of the system. The one that we played together apparently was a better example of what that system looked like.
So here's the thing. In the course of my doing this so far, I've played a couple games that didn't really have any system.
And you played Fate Core.
And I played Fate, and now this one. What'd you call it?
Powered by the Apocalypse is what it's called. Apocalypse. The original game it was on was called Apocalypse World.
And I think...
So they call the system Powered by the Apocalypse.
I think of the 10 or so games I've played, I've only played... Most of them didn't have any kind of particular system.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I've only played Fate.
David likes a lot of those indie games.
So I've only played the two systems,
just sort of
so to
cooperative
speak.
Storytelling kind of things and stuff. And so all the stuff you played at the con was powered by the apocalypse.
Or
possibly Fate, because I was between those two,
or,
that's like 90% of
or
the games.
Or nothing in particular.
Oh, or was it sort of a systemless? Yeah,
I'm trying to remember the lay down your head one, or don't lay down your head, or whatever.
Don't rest your head.
Don't rest your head. Yeah, I don't know. That seemed like that had something. Some kind of system, maybe. Maybe it didn't. I don't remember. I don't remember these things. Like, this is a problem. If I went to a game and someone said, "Oh, this is," even if they said this is the Fate system, which I've probably played more than anything else up to this point,
yeah.
I'd still probably have to have them explain it to me a little bit because I don't. It's not really sinking in that stuff.
You're still very, very baby as a gamer.
What interested you about the Apocalypse deal?
Well, time, just because it's been very popular. And people seem to like it, so I didn't really know anything about the system.
But why do people like it?
I don't know. It's very handy for narrative in a lot of ways that Fate is, but it's its own system. I mean, things are focused on moves. There aren't skills and things like that. You've got your basic attributes that are just modifiers to a dice roll, but everything is in moves. Like, remember we had our big list of moves,
mm-hmm.
and so you had, like, takedown or avoid danger or stuff like that. And this is a good technique. Fate uses this a little bit. Fate Core, I think, has changed it slightly, but in the Fate games I played before, they sort of have moves. They have most of the actions, especially for combat, can be attacks or blocks or maneuvers, and everything falls into those categories. And it's the same thing here. It's a more narrative style. Say, okay, forget any rules.
Okay.
Tell me what you want to do.
I see.
And you say it, and we've got these moves set up, and so we can apply that. And they're very context unspecific. So it's not, I am going to attempt to physically harm this guy. That's in most games. It's like, okay, what do you have that you're going to harm them with? In what way are you, like, you know? And so you roll your sword, or you roll your guns, or whatever. And this is much more, I'm going to try and do some weird shit. Okay, well, the ultimate effect is this, which would be, you know, a takedown. And so you do that. And within the moves, if you have a success, you have various options. I kind of thought that was cool. So, like, in a takedown, takedown is the easiest example, because that's the, like, attacking people kind of thing. And so you have a takedown, and if you roll, there's levels of success. And depending on those levels, you get points. I think he called them hold, but you get like 2 or 3 points, or you fail. And then there's a list of things you can do, and they cost a various number of points. So, like, some of them are 1 point, and some of them are 2 points, and some of them are 3 points. So you can be like, I'm going to do this one and this one. And remember, like, we had that when you would succeed on the takedown, and if you used all 3 points on a condition, you could get them in a critical condition. Mm, mm. But then you couldn't take the one where you get take no harm. Mm, mm, so mm. Then we'd mix those up. And the whole, for 1 point, you can force a change in location, but the GM decides where it is. Mm, mm-hmm, for two, you get to decide. I feel like that's a really nice narrative model and pretty simple, and pretty fast paced. I was really fascinated by the complete lack of any sort of initiative system. There is no mechanical system for determining who goes when, which is both awesome and terrifying, because going when can make a big difference, but on the other hand, can be a pain in the ass to keep track of for no good reason in some cases.
Yeah, right. Hearing you explain it like that makes me understand it a lot better, because as someone who's just playing it, I'm just trying to figure out how it works.
Yes.
And I have nothing really to compare it to.
And you don't... here's the thing. This is where you get more like me, and if you really get out there, you get like David. We get very meta about it. We are into the craft of role-playing games. There are lots of people out there who game forever and ever, and they don't really pay attention to that kind of stuff. They will learn the rules as rote, but they're not like, okay, why do we do this way? What does this mean?
Yeah.
And David especially is obsessed with this, and I'm very much into it. What is this system trying to accomplish, and how well does it do it compared to, say, this system?
Mm-hmm.
What are the pros and cons of this? In terms of the kind of game you're trying to play.
Right.
And I am, as much as I enjoy, like, taking Fate and using it for everything, there is a school of thought that I tend to believe in that is different systems flavor different games. There's, if you're gonna play this genre and style of game, it's really gonna work better if you use this kind of system versus that kind of system.
Well, so what's the basic reason to having a system at all? Does it come down to, like, you know, when you're playing cops and robbers when you're kids, and you, one kid shoots the other kid, okay, you're dead. No, I'm not dead. You missed me, you know. So you get in a big argument about what really happened. Is that like the main reason why they have systems at all, is because you need something to give to ground the thing so that there's something that's not just a matter of people's opinion? Or
I think that's the basis originally. I mean, in a perfect world with a perfect group, you could sit around and talk and everybody could decide for themselves, and your character is, you know, Robin Hood. It's like, okay, Robin Hood, what are you going to do? Oh, I'm going to try and do this thing. Okay, would you succeed at that? and if you're good, you could be like, I think it's going to be more interesting if I don't.
If I don't,
or like,
right,
I don't think I could, or yeah, I totally would. And there are games that sort of try and play it. But also, there's a certain tension where it says, did you do it? And there's no tension if you just pick. I mean, there's tension for the rest of us, but you're like, I'll just pick whether I did or not. There's some tension, and you're like, I don't know, let's see if I did.
Well,
and then you roll the dice and you're like, oh, because if you hear real gaming stories, you'll get that kind of thing. It's like, oh, it was so close, and then I missed that one shot.
No. I think as you're talking about it, I'm getting the impression, too, that if you're the player, part of the fun is experiencing what your character experiences along with your character.
Yes,
and there's
even in an area to play, because that's the big thing, is there's different... That I'm largely talking from the perspective of a narrativist game.
Yeah, right.
Although some would say that's a little bit more simulationist than the stuff. If you're playing simulationist or gamist, then you absolutely need a system, because in a gamist situation, you need to know who's winning or
who's
what the risk is and the buy. There's an inherent gambling thing.
Yeah.
And in a simulationist, you need random laws of fate.
Yeah.
You know. An expert swordsman is still only going to be able to pull this off X percent of the time. So this particular time, did you fall into that percent, or did you not?
But and then even in a very narrative type of game, which, I mean, I don't know. The only thing I know about role-playing games is what I know from my friends and their experiences, and probably mostly from you because you talk about it.
Yeah.
But I'm going to guess that if I studied it out meticulously, I would come to the conclusion that I prefer a narrative style of game. And
I discovered that I'd mostly been playing simulationist and that I preferred narrativist. But we also should say this is the game is narrativist simulationist theory is a somewhat outdated theory now. I still really like it, but there are more recent theories that encompass things better.
But
that's just the one I fall back
on. But I think...
certain type of nerd. There are so many gamers out there who would have no idea what we're talking about right now.
But I think as I'm thinking about it...
Your anus is just right up in my business.
What?
I'm not enjoying this.
One reason I might want there to be a system sort of mediating the game that I'm playing is because I want to experience a little of what my character experiences.
Yeah.
I don't just want to be the author of my character's experience and not experience what my character's experiencing.
And it's a difference, obviously, to a degree, if you just want to be the author, write a damn story.
Yeah, right.
And you could say, oh, no, but then there's other people involved in it. Well, okay, then write a collaborative
story. Yeah, collaborative story.
Which is arguably a type of role-playing. But this is different. You're trying to go, I always like the Isaac Asimov thing, and that if you do a role-playing game just right, you walk away with a real memory.
Well, that's what I'm... Yeah, so that's exactly what I'm thinking about is... Even from the perspective of psychology that uses role-playing in therapeutic situations, you're not really role-playing unless you're... Some part of you... doesn't have to be every part of you or all of you, but some part of you has to be in the role.
Yes.
And yes, when you write or... when you write a story, like when you write a piece of fiction and you're writing a character, you get into it. That's true, but it's not the same as role-playing, really.
No. It's role-playing is halfway between that and community theater.
Yeah, exactly.
Or improv. The parallels with improv are huge.
So what the system then serves to do, especially, and I guess I do have to say I'm probably speaking mostly of narrative-style games, is it facilitates that participation of the player and the player's character getting into that character but doing so in a way that doesn't constrain the player so much that it limits their narrative.
Yeah.
Their narrative scope. So when you sit down to make a system, which you'll want to do again, because you want to get that buy-in by the player. That's the trick is to maximize buy-in so that the player is experiencing what the character experiences while not constraining what choices the player can make.
Yeah.
That's tricky, I would think.
And then there's all sorts of features to it. The Blades in the Dark game, which I played before, I played that. That was the earlier game I played. On Rolls had a bunch of stuff that you could, that was optional to add. When you were going to roll something, you could spend a certain level of stress to give yourself another die. Or somebody else could spend some stress to assist you, and then they would give you a die. And on top of that, the GM would, whenever possible, try and come up with a devil's bargain. Which is to say, he will give you another die, but something bad would happen. And it was always separated from the success or failure. So whether you succeed or fail at this, I'll give you an extra die to try if this other thing happens. So like you're trying to attack this guy or whatever, and you say, okay, here's the devil's bargain. Whether you succeed or not, you've made enough noise to alert everyone else. And if you take it, you get an extra die, but then whether you hit that guy or not, everyone else is alerted.
But what you just described, couldn't you do the exact same thing in the fate system in a way?
Absolutely. It happens in the fate system. Yeah. You get awarded fate points for complicating your life.
Right.
Because it makes it more interesting. This is a relatively new trend of you get bonuses for screwing yourself over because it makes a more interesting story. in general, and it's a, I mean, not everything, but as a general rule, the more complicated, the more difficult things are made, as long as it's done creatively, the more interesting the story that comes out of it. It's one thing to say, I'm a crack shot and I shoot that guy in the head. And then it's like, oh, but I had to shoot him in the head while the wind was blowing. And it's way more exciting then.
But it's
way more interesting. Or I had to shoot him in the head in front of witnesses. That's way more exciting. And a bunch of shit's going to come out from that one.
But the things you were saying also about the apocalypse system too, some of the things you were saying that it could do or that it was doing, again, I can see someone doing the same thing with the Fate system. Yes,
there are definite parallels. And I mean, David, I'm sure, could speak at length about this, but I very much think they are two systems that both quite well are attempting to do essentially the same thing. Is there a gaming system lineage? I think so. I don't know that it's codified specifically, but I mean, in general, systems have built on earlier systems. Oh, we did. Well, and that's the thing. And then you get concepts that are just there. Hit points. Been around forever. Now there are games that aren't so much using hit points. But even then, it's an abstraction. Like, I believe the Blades in the Dark guy was like, these are kind of like your hit points. Not exactly, but kind of. Fate. Different versions of Fate, your stress levels can be considered hit points or not. And in fact, in the two campaigns I've recently run, in one of them, they very much are not like hit points. In another one, they very much are like hit points. I think things get built because the system is inherent to role-playing. The other reason you need a system is you need some damn rules. Otherwise, you're a group of people in a giant white space just inventing shit with your mind, which is fun, but it's very different. Most role-playing games, you want the structure at least to tell a story, a specific kind of story. And if you have no system, then you're just telling whatever the fuck story you want.
Well, we played, on Sunday, we play-tested a game called Dr. Chaos, and I explained it to you a little bit.
Yeah.
Where, before the game, everyone collectively defines this Dr. Chaos character, who is the main villain. And the way you're supposed to build this character is, this is a super duper, I mean, this villain is like, there's no way anyone could beat this villain, basically, that you create. And also there shouldn't be anything corny about the villain either. You need to take the villain seriously. But then, after you've created this villain, everyone plays heroes that they make up on the spot. You don't, no stats, anything. Yeah. You just make up a superhero. And the idea is it's a comic book superhero, right? So you just... That's the only rule, is that it...
Seriously, this is not helpful for anybody.
Is that the character you create is in a comic book genre. And so one player plays Dr. Chaos in a round, and everyone else makes up these heroes. And in the next round, another player plays Dr. Chaos, and in that second round, you can either create a whole new hero from scratch when your turn comes up, or you can assume a hero that someone else created in the last round, but you can't ever play the same hero twice. Mm-hmm. And that's it.
Yeah.
There are no other rules. There's a mechanic where after your turn, so on a turn, say, so it's your turn, and so now you're gonna create a hero, so you make this hero up. And the hero has three different, like, there's a name, there's a style, which defines the hero's powers.
Yeah.
And there's a look. You know, you get to say what that character looks like. And then you say what the character's doing to stop this bad guy.
Yeah.
And then what you're trying to do is to one-up, you know, whatever the person playing the villain said, well, the villain's doing this. So when it comes to your turn, you make up something to counter it.
Yeah. Seriously, we can't keep doing this, Edgy. Stay the fuck down
there. And so you give this grand comic booky thing, and then when you're done, you've got a hand of seven standard playing cards.
Yeah.
And when you're done, you draw a card and you discard a card, and what you're trying to build is a gin rummy hand.
Yeah.
And then the next person goes and they do the same thing until it gets around to the person playing the villain. And so then they make up something that undoes everything the heroes just did. And they're playing, trying to build a rummy hand off their own deck.
Yeah.
And then it goes to the next person around. So really the only hard and fast rule to the system is you're playing rummy underneath the game.
Yeah, yeah.
And when someone has gin, that stops the
scene.
The round. Yeah. And that's basically, it's a timing mechanism.
Yeah.
And there are some things that matter if the bad guy, person playing the bad guy gets gin or a hero gets gin. But other than that, there's...
So it becomes this weird sort of reverse hot potato.
Kind of. So, in a way, narrative-wise, there's hardly any rules at all. Except we're working in the comic book genre,
yeah.
And so keep it within that genre, basically. Yeah. And don't ever say anything cheesy about the bad guy, but your hero can be as cheesy as you want. So you end up, it ends up being, everyone's trying to one-up the bad guy, but it seemed like what happened in this game was that the people playing the heroes didn't have a lot of opportunities to collaborate with one another.
No, from what you described, I wouldn't think so.
Yeah. Right, so each person is almost telling the story as if they're describing a comic book where their particular hero is the hero.
And
that wasn't just so fun for me.
Well, and those sort of systems, such as they are, primarily also only work for one-shots.
Well, yeah, it couldn't have been a campaign. Yeah.
And then there's a whole level of buy-in that you don't have that way. You don't get to see your character improve. You, to a degree, you don't even really get to get deep into your character.
Yeah.
Because only playing them for one scene. You don't get to see the whole thing grow. Character relationships don't evolve over time because
you don't really role play the character at all.
No.
You're really just telling the story of the character.
There are versions of this that are still role playing, but the ones that tend to get the very, when you get out to that level of looseness on a system,
mm-hmm.
often it can't hold longer than that.
Well, I think if I were going to describe a game that I would think was ideal for me personally, it would be one where all the players can collaborate, like that strict turn taking thing, yeah. Or even a game that like you roll for initiative and what each person does something one at a time. I don't think I prefer that. I think I prefer something where, you know, the GM gives the scenario and all of us who are together on this team of whatever it is, we can talk to one another and we can coordinate action. And the order of how people do things comes from us figuring it out together. Or if it's one of those situations where our characters wouldn't actually have an opportunity to sit there and talk about it, there's some way where we can act that still takes the other people into account, or what someone just did, or whatever. You follow what I'm trying to say?
Yes, but then you get into a thing. Because in some cases, you can only collaborate insofar as your characters actually could.
Right, right.
Which is very limiting.
Sometimes
limiting. And in other versions, you can collaborate outside of that because then you can craft a better narrative.
But it's
And in some versions, you can collaborate outside of that, but you have to be very careful to separate the information that William knows versus the information
Right. So I guess what I'm saying is there was one game we played that... we sort of made up it was kind of like the Serenity universe, but not exactly. Yeah. But what that allowed us to do was, in certain situations, we couldn't collaborate because, as you just pointed out, sometimes a character didn't know what was going on because characters were in different places, or sometimes the action was unfolding so quickly, you just had to kind of do whatever. But even in those contexts, it was sort of kind of freewheeling. You just did what you could, and it was fun and it worked out. And then when it was all over and you're on the ship going somewhere, you can all sit around the table and talk about what happened and what we're all going to do next.
Yeah.
And I loved that.
Yeah.
But so, you know, that
it wasn't Bulldogs, was it? Did you play Bulldogs?
No, we made this we made this scenario up, but I mean, I don't know. And Dave was running it, you know, Dave just kind of can on the fly do whatever he wants. Absolutely. So I don't know if he was using any, I don't remember if he was borrowing from a system or if he was using
Dave's
fate.
The king of yes and.
It seems like when he wants some system to run just whatever gaming style he's making up on the fly, that he'll just grab fate and adapt it to whatever he's doing.
Yeah, which is interesting because I don't feel like he always was that in favor of fate. Is interesting, but
well, I just think of it.
For a while, he was using a different one called PDQ Sharp.
Well, I think he used,
which I experimented a little bit. I played with him a little bit.
I think he used Fate because it was there. Not because he thought it was best.
Fate Core is a different game than previous versions of Fate in some ways, and that can clean things up a little. We better draw something out of the hat, or else people are going to revolt. But I really should send you to some of these game theory, or gaming theory, I should say. I don't want to confuse it with the actual discipline.
Well, you have sent me stuff before, okay. And I've read it. I don't remember all of the terminology or whatever, but when you're talking about narrative and simulated
now,
and
of course,
stuff,
when it's me who's been playing for 32 years, some stuff that I like in games, I like a fair simulation, and it's just because that's what I've been raised in, and to me, that's what gaming is. So if you go too far out on the spectrum, it starts to feel weird to me and not what I'm looking
for. Right, but aren't video games by definition simulation?
Oh, absolutely. No, but I'm talking about I've been doing role-playing games.
No, I know, but for a person who likes video games and they want to play a role-playing game, they might find themselves preferring something that feels like video games they played.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that's what 4th edition D&D was. They were finally like, why don't we just make it World of Warcraft? Because everybody loves that. and it's also why, although I was raised in it and use the thing, when I call a video game a role-playing game, I'm like, it's not really, though.
Yeah.
At best, it's a choose-your-own-adventure book. And even then, it's usually not that. All right, what you got?
Given the XB1, if backwards compatible with the 360, will you buy one and embrace both worlds now? Cheers, Stu.
Wow.
I don't even understand this question.
It's in Welsh. Let's break it down here. Given the XB1, the Xbox One, which is the current gen of Xbox, is backwards compatible with the 360, will I buy one? Or will you buy one? And then we'll have both consoles. Well, first off, I don't have any current gen consoles.
Well, we have the PS4, but we've never owned an Xbox. Yeah. I mean, the only stuff our household has ever owned is Sony. That's it.
Yeah.
We've never owned anything else.
I am buying the PS4 first. There's a variety of reasons for that. One of them is that my wife has informed me I'm buying the PS4 first. One of them is the PS4 is infinitely more popular. Like, it has shaken out and people say it's better. One is, in general, I like the controls and the menus and Sony stuff better. And so that's what we're going to get. Eventually, I'm sure I will get an Xbox One. But, except here's the problem right now. Tell me the exclusive titles on Xbox One. Because the only one I know about right now is Titanfall. Well, and I'm not playing Titanfall.
Well, this is the reason we've never got an Xbox, is because there's the only reason to get one, the only reason to get anything other than the Sony consoles, is if the other consoles have exclusive titles that we want.
And, actually,
and they never do.
There were also other cases where one console ran a game really shitty and the other one didn't.
Well,
But more of an issue of once I owned both of them, which one did I pick?
But
in the day, your only source for Fable has always been Xbox. But I don't think they're making any more of those. If they were, that would almost be enough for me. There was a time when your only source for Mass Effect was Xbox.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. Originally, Mass Effect only came out on Xbox.
Wow.
And then Mass Effect 2 came out on both, but Mass Effect 1 still never came out on the PlayStation for the longest time.
Wow.
And then eventually, they released the whole trilogy. But originally, it was Xbox exclusive. Other things that I hoped would be awesome, Too Human was Xbox exclusive, turned out to suck. But then, yeah, Sony had its own. All the Ratchet and Clank stuff was PlayStation specific. The little Big Planet stuff was PlayStation specific.
And we've never heard of a title. I mean, I think there was one time there was a Batman game that was, or maybe it was some Star Wars games that were on Xbox or something that weren't on PlayStation, and we felt a little, but it was like one game or one set of games. Yeah. Why buy a whole console just for that? It just didn't seem to make sense. Now, man, the thing about Mass Effect, what you said about Mass Effect just then, I'd say in my household, for all media, the top sci-fi story and environment for us is probably Mass Effect.
I adore it. I list it as my favorite gaming series at this point.
Now, there's a little bit of an exception there for me because I still like Asimov's novels and all that stuff.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So that probably ties. But aside from that, it's probably our favorite. And on the fantasy side, it's probably Dragon Age.
Yep. Which is also BioWare.
Yes, exactly.
Yep.
And running a close second would be Fallout and Elder Scrolls, right?
Yeah.
So I can't imagine our household not being able to play those games.
Yep.
I didn't really realize that.
Well, and it's becoming less of a thing. There are fewer and fewer exclusive titles.
Yeah.
So, I mean, Stu, you may have to work on making an argument to me for that. At the moment, Stu wants somebody else to have an Xbox One because Stu recently got an Xbox One, and so he wants friends. I don't play online, though, so fuck right off.
See, we don't either. We don't do that.
But if you just want to, you know, be budsies about it, you got to give me, first of all, you got to give me a compelling reason, and then you got to wait, because here's the thing. I am probably minutes away from finishing Amalur. Like, I already beat the end guy and found out he wasn't really the end guy, and there's another end guy, and I've already had somebody explain to me all the stuff I'm missing from my amnesia that I have. I feel like I'm just making jokes, but these are real things. Like with most video games of this sort, the end boss is not really the end boss, and I'm now going to go see the real end boss, and I totally had amnesia, and now somebody has explained to me what I really am. So I'm really close to the end. As soon as I'm done with that, I play Assassin's Creed Rogue. When I'm done with that, I think I get a PS4. Those were the last games that I had to, that are previous gen only, that I wanted to play.
Well, my wife is finishing her fifth playthrough of Dragon Age.
I was just telling somebody about that today.
She's almost done, and then she's going to get the DLC, the 2 years later DLC.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully she'll have all of that done before November 10th or whatever, because then
Fallout 4,
yeah. And that's going to be the game we're playing through the holidays is Fallout
Somebody
4.
Just today was like, because I was talking about all the games, like, aren't you going to play Fallout? I thought you liked Fallout. I'm like, I do. I'm a late adopter. I'm going to get a PS4 after Assassin's Creed Rogue. I am going to play, bare minimum, Dragon Age Inquisition, Shadows of Mordor, and Assassin's Creed Unity. That will probably take me a year.
Yeah, a long
right
time.
There.
Yep.
Eventually, I will totally play Fallout 4, and I will probably love it. But I never do them right away. The closest time ever was Mass Effect 3. I got it remarkably soon after it had been out, because it was on a flash sale on Amazon. And once I had it, I couldn't wait. And so I started it. But that's like the only game ever that I play relatively soon to when it comes out. Just never happens for me.
What's going to happen in our house is we'll start playing Fallout, and probably around Christmas time we'll start talking about how we can't wait for Mass Effect Andromeda to come out, because I think we're both kind of missing Mass Effect.
Yeah,
like,
but isn't it going to be like years?
No, I think, well, it's a year. I thought it was 2016. Maybe not. I might be wrong about that, something got me looking up some Mass Effect stuff a couple days ago. Like, what was that thing in Mass Effect? And I looked it up, and I ended up looking at the stuff longer than I'd intended.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
it was
yeah,
just
yeah,
a quick
yeah,
check
yeah.
of something, because, you know, in the fiction I'm writing, there's a different kinds of physics and science and stuff. And I thought, well, does this sound too much like Mass Effect or whatever? So I went to check, and it didn't. But I thought, oh, yeah, that was cool. That was cool. And that was cool. And I just kept digging into it. It's like, wow, I really miss this game. That's what pisses me. I miss this a lot.
Got tons of DLC that actually mattered. Like, actually had
story. And yeah, we didn't even play a lot of it.
I played some of them, but a lot of them I just had to go read. Because, yeah, especially between 2 and 3, they kept coming out with DLCs to basically keep you busy until 3 came out. And they were ones that, like, hinted at the next stuff that was going to come. It was really interesting. And I'm, you know, I'm one of those people who loved the original ending to Mass Effect 3, too. I never downloaded the extra ending. I read about it, but I liked the ending where it was. I was like, this is like the fucking end of Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. It's left intentionally vague, and I love that.
I don't remember us having a particular problem with it. We downloaded the other one just to see what it was like, but it
was didn't the same thing, but with more pictures and narration.
Kind of, yeah.
Because nobody could cope with it, so it had to be, oh, this person. It was basically the equivalent of the end of goddamn Animal House, where they had to tell you where everybody ended up afterwards. It was that kind of shit. Because people can't cope with the ambiguous ending. And with video games, as opposed to with movies, you can just bitch about it, and eventually they'll change and give you DLC with a different ending. Because we're all assholes, people, and stop it. We're over time. We should wrap this up.
Okay.
So go to the blog, themagicaltalkinghat.com, and tell us about your role-playing experiences and why Stu wants us all to get Xbox Ones. And like us on Facebook. And send your questions into the hat, because we need them. themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. And listen again next week. Do you know what I love best about when we do this stuff?
What's that?
Is not talking to you. That's the terrible part.
Right.
But at the end here, I know it's going to be a week before I have to do it again. And tomorrow's Friday.
Yet another mystery solved by the hosts of the Magical Talking Hat. Do you have a question that begs to be answered? Then please write the hat at themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. That's themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. Also, visit the hat at themagicaltalkinghat.com. The music for this episode was provided by Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com.